Call to order the House Higher Education and Finance and Policy Committee to order. We do have a quorum, and I'd like to have someone make a motion to approve the minutes.
So moved.
Mr. Chair, so moved.
Was that Representative Christensen? All right. Any discussion? This is for March the 4th. Hearing none, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Minutes are approved. We have, four bills today, and the first one is Representative Norton. Representative Norton, would you like to move your bill?
Yes, Mr. Chair, I'd like to move House File 1108 for passage, and I believe in to be considered for...
It'll be laid over for possible inclusion in the final. That's right.
Right.
So, Representative Norton, you can begin.
Sure. Mr. Chair, members, the bill before you is simply written, although I think you're going to find it interesting when you hear what that simply written bill entails. And currently we're asking for $8 million to be included in the base. And just for your information, currently in the base, it has been dropped down to 7.491 per year. This is bringing it back up to the 8 that had originally been intended a number of years ago. So it's a slight adjustment to the base formula compared with what currently is in law. And this is to fund collaborative research partnerships between the University of Minnesota and the Mayo Clinic. And they've done lots of wonderful work over the years. And I think at some point we're going to have a timeline for you. I don't think we're quite ready yet, but we're working on a timeline for you to see, since this was this partnership was created back in 2003. Governor Tim Pawlenty came down to Rochester, and it was at a State of the State. I happened to be at that in the audience. It was long before I was a legislator, and he made the announcement about the partnership between these two wonderful research institutions. And so I'm hoping we'll have a timeline for you so you can see, since 2003, when that germ was planted, that seed was planted, what has happened to create a wonderful research partnership that I think is envied. And I'll let the two gentlemen, the one to my right and the one to my left, I don't know what order they're going to go in, to explain what they're going to do with that money.
Hey, please identify yourself for the record and then begin.
Sure. Mr. Chair, I'm Dr. Eric Weaven from the Mayo Clinic.
Mr. Chair, I'm Tucker LeBian from the University of Minnesota.
Okay. Welcome to both of you.
Thank you. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Representative Norton, I thought we'd begin here with just a few words about the history of the partnership, and Representative Norton has given you the basic highlight and timeline. But the partnership was formed in 2003. The first grants were awarded in 2004 in the areas of heart disease, Alzheimer's disease, prostate cancer, and obesity research. And that was done with a $2 million appropriation matched by $1 million from Mayo and $1 million from the University of Minnesota. And that was done as a proof of principle. And the outcomes of those initial projects were so promising that the partnership funding has continued since that time at various levels. And since that time, the partnership has funded 66 full joint research projects, 17 infrastructure projects, and additional seed grants, strategic recruitments, and commercialization funding. And it's just the tip of the iceberg in terms of what's happened with some of these projects. One of those four initial projects, the one in prostate cancer, identified some markers for aggressive versus non-aggressive prostate cancer. And that work has now gone through a commercialization phase and additional research and validation, and has now been licensed to a commercial entity. So that was one of the initial success stories, but it also illustrates that success in this arena can take a number of years, because that licensing only occurred in 2013. Since that time, these other research projects have funded a lot of projects in the areas of cancer, heart disease, neurodegenerative disease, but also in some other areas that people might not associate with the Minnesota Partnership in Biotechnology and Medical Genomics. So, for example, we funded a project that has helped to identify some improved pesticides for soybean aphids. We funded a project developing novel antifungal drugs, which has also entered a commercialization phase, and some new drugs have been identified to treat really devastating fungal infections. And we funded a project on novel treatments for cocaine addiction, which has survived some of this process and moved into animal trials. So those are just a few of the types of things that we've done. And I'd like to note that the infrastructure funding that we've provided as well in these competitive research processes has also had big payoffs. And this is one that's near to my heart, because with Minnesota Partnership funding in a competitive process, one of the projects in 2007 funded the purchase of the first high-throughput genomic sequencing instrument in Minnesota. And that gave us a start towards getting into this important area of technology. And now that machine has been replaced several times over and has led to the creation at Mayo of what we call the Medical Genome Center that I direct. And this is something that now has 10 different high-throughput genome sequencers that sequence 1,000 times faster than that first one. And this is an operation which now employs 40 people at Mayo. So it's the type of thing that has fulfilled the promise of both improving our knowledge of medical genomics and applying that to patient care, and in terms of providing some jobs. And that Medical Genome Center is part of our Center for Individualized Medicine, which is another big new initiative at Mayo, which again is providing hundreds of jobs in that context. The last thing I'll say before turning it over to Dr. LeBien is that one of the other outcomes from Minnesota partnership activities so far has been the attraction of over $100 million in incremental funding to state research endeavors, including multi-million dollar support both from industry, the highlight of which was a $5 million grant from Medica in support of partnership activities, and $10 million from the European Union in support of research here in Minnesota. So we've been bringing in additional dollars from other sources to help move our objectives forward. So those are just a few of the highlights. Dr. LeBien is going to talk about one or two things of interest to him and some new initiative that we have are just beginning.
Okay, thank
Dr.
you.
Dr. LeBien, is it?
Thank you. Yes.
Pronounce it right? Okay.
Yes, thank you.
Welcome.
So let me share with you a new initiative that we've carved out of the partnership recently, and then I'd also like to make just a very brief kind of broad comment about what I think this partnership means to the two institutions. So, as Eric described, since the inception of the program 10 or 11 years ago, it has always been the understanding that the research that we identified as being the most significant in the type of research we wanted to invest in was not only high-quality science, but had commercialization potential and had, therefore, the potential to impact jobs for the citizens of Minnesota and all of the things that I think the legislators 11 years ago expected that this project would have. And we've stayed true to that formula. But as I think many of you know, biomedical research, despite our best efforts, can be a fairly protracted activity that takes a long time to bear fruit. So what we did a year ago was to develop a program that has just been implemented that has a slightly different flavor to it. And in its simplest form, it looks like this. We have a new program called the Translational Product Development Fund, or the TPDF, which I apologize for yet another acronym, but you know, just like other organizations, we have to have those to keep tabs on all our activities. This program, which is part of the partnership, has a starting point, if you will, that is a little different from the typical grant program. So our historical grant program, we solicit applications from all areas of biomedical research, they get reviewed, we fund the best science, and we also have an eye toward the commercialization potential of those projects. In this new program, the starting point is that the projects must have already made an invention disclosure before we will consider them. So an invention disclosure is, of course, a confidential document that is developed by the inventor, that is submitted to either the Office of Office of Technology Commercialization at the university or Mayo Clinic Ventures in Rochester. And this is, in essence, the description of an invention that then allows our technology experts to determine whether there's potential patentability. So this grant program starts with that as a key variable to the funding equation. And what we expect this will do is allow us to invest in research projects, and we're thinking we'll probably fund about five or six in the first year, that are dramatically further along the commercialization pathway than many of the ones that we funded in the past. It doesn't mean that the science is better or the science is worse. It simply means that we're selecting projects that have the potential, in fact, I would argue, the likelihood of leading to commercialization of a diagnostic test, of a new prognostic tool, of a new type of software, of a new type of smartphone that can monitor your blood pressure. These are the types of projects that we're seeing. So we're quite excited about this. Andrew Badley at Mayo and I are the principal investigators on this, and I fully anticipate that if you're interested and willing to invite us back next year, that we're going to have a very significant progress report to be able to show to you. The only thing I'd like to comment on, and then I think Eric and I would be delighted to take questions, is that biomedical research, in my opinion, is a rough and tumble business. It's highly competitive. It's now conducted in an environment of decreasing funding by the National Institutes of Health over the last 10 years, and institutional collaborations have become essential. So I can tell you that the support that you've provided to this partnership over the last 10 years has been unique nationwide in its purpose and unique nationwide in its outcome in bringing the two research powerhouses in the state of Minnesota together. Now, I can tell you from just a personal standpoint, I know you're not necessarily interested in my personal sentiments, but this one is, of the responsibilities I have, is one of the most gratifying I've participated in, and working with our Mayo Clinic colleagues has been a great success story. So I really appreciate your willingness to consider continued funding.
Representative Norton?
Yep. I'd just like to add just a few more comments. I think one thing to remember is when this first started, it was funded out of the Department of Economic Development, and it was considered an economic development tool. Over time, I don't think anyone has, and in fact, I'm really pleased to hear of this latest project. I don't think anybody has backed off on that, but I think there came with experience an understanding that we also needed time in order for these things to actually go from research to the bench, to the marketplace, and we had to wait it out. So during that time that we were waiting, trying, you know, sometimes impatiently, and they would hear from us periodically for when is this going to go to the bench? When are we going to see a product? And now we have that. But in those early years, it was moved from the Department of Economic Development funding to the University of Minnesota as a direct and special line item. And so in 2003, as was mentioned, it started with $2 million. In 2005, there was $15 million put in over the biennium. In 2007, $25 million was put in. And then in 2009, it was dropped to $16 million, but put in the base. And so it was made a permanent entity in the university. The last couple years, we've seen drops to bienniums. We've seen drops in 2011 and 13 to 14.92. And so this is to raise it back up to the higher amount, to the 16 in the biennium. So, and frankly, Mr. Chair and members, there are other bills that we're seeing, not in this committee probably, but in Health and Human Services and others, that are asking for funding for research. And as you've heard, these projects actually cover some of that research and could cover more. So if we want to bump up the genomics partnership beyond the 8 and take it back up to where it was at 25, I don't think anybody here would argue with that effort. And so you might keep that in mind as you're grappling at the end of the day with these other research requests and how we might do that. So, Mr. Chair, that's all I have right now, and we'll happy to, they'll answer questions. They'll be happy to answer questions.
All right. I don't have a list yet, but I can take some. Representative Pugh.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Well, I just have a question about the research process, the various phases. You mentioned, Doctor, about the commercialization phase, and I'm just wondering if you could just walk us through all of the various phases that a research project would go through.
Sure, Mr. Chair, Representative Pugh.
Weben,
thank
okay.
you.
Go ahead.
Sure, I'll take the first stab at that one and rely on my colleague to correct me and expand on my answer. But yeah, the partnership process begins with the application phase. So this is always a competitive process. And for full research projects, we funded less than 1 in 5 applications. So the investigators have to come up with a good idea and then prepare a written research protocol, which gets reviewed in a very competitive fashion. And if they're successful, then that project is kicked off. But that review process typically takes on the order of 6 months because we get a large number of applications. I think in the last round of applications, we had over 40 applications. And these are quite substantial. And to do a good job with review, it takes a while. So there's this get it started phase. And then after the dollars have actually been allocated, the research teams, typically we fund for 2 years. So they have 2 years to get their project started, bring it to some sort of outcomes and conclusions. And a lot of times they'll ask for a little bit of an extension to wrap things up and get publications done. But that again, it's a fairly substantial process. And then assuming things are successful with a given project, and you know, we've talked with Representative Norton, and clearly this is a research process, and one of the goals of this process for the Minnesota Partnership is to fund cutting-edge things that are a little riskier than the average project that you could submit to NIH or other national funding agencies. So, but if it's been successful, then there needs to be some validation of that initial work that's funded by somebody else usually. And if it survives that phase, then on 3 occasions, we've actually progressed to, within the Minnesota Partnership, what we call commercialization funding, which makes an additional aliquot of funding available to try and get it through what's sometimes called the valley of death, between the basic science and the commercialization side of things. And that, again, can take a couple of years of trying to make this product strong enough and facile enough to be adopted in a commercial environment. And going along with this is all the intellectual property type of activities. So the intellectual property offices are filing disclosures and patent applications and other sorts of things. And then eventually you've got that portfolio put together and you start discussing it with various commercial entities and see if there's interest in licensing and further things. And that's why for that initial project that was applied for in 2004, the licensing actually came through in 2013.
Dr. Levine, do you have anything to add to that?
The clarity is remarkable, of course. Just briefly, the commercialization proposal that I just described, this Translational Product Development Fund, is really a marriage with the other grant program and is going to take these projects as they're further along toward commercialization. And also, and I didn't expand on this because I didn't have the opportunity. What we're going to do is put what we call a project development team around each one of these grants. And this team is going to help move the science forward toward a commercialization endpoint and bring to the table expertise that might be needed in the business regulatory area or in the diagnostic arena, et cetera, to help build kind of a more disciplined team effort to move this forward. So I think this is going to be a wonderful complement. It's a bit of an experiment, but I am quite optimistic about the potential for this.
Thank you.
Members, have any other questions? Anyone? Oh, Representative Barrett.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and to the testifiers and to Representative Norton. Regarding, you know, I've heard the word commercialization a lot, and so it really begged the question I would have regarding the licensing or the money that would come back to the university and or Mayo Clinic regarding projects that were funded through this grant. And it's been around for a while. What happens to that money? And I'm really thinking of Mayo more than I am the U of M. Since public money was used for those projects, since Mayo would be getting some reciprocal benefit, does that money also get flow back into the state budget in some way, since we've funded some of that in the past?
Dr. Wiebe?
Mr. Chair, Representative, one of the important considerations as we began the partnership was to deal with some of those issues in advance. And one of the first agreements we had was that any proceeds from partnership activities would be split 50-50 between the two organizations, regardless of who did more or what, because that cuts down on a lot of those things. And then at the institutional level, both institutions have agreed to put any funding that comes back into partnership activities to, over time, try to build a sustainable base for these types of activities.
That's absolutely correct.
Okay. Representative Barrett, to follow up?
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. So thank you for that answer. How much money has been flowed back into partnership activities from the royalties from projects since many years ago?
Dr. Wiebe?
Mr. Chair, Representative, that's a relatively easy one from my perspective, and the answer is I'm sorry, but I don't have an actual figure for you on that. Since this licensing agreement went into effect only about a year ago, I would suspect that, you know, it's on the order of thousands of dollars, not hundreds of thousands or millions of dollars at this point. But I don't have those actual figures in front of me, and I don't.
Yeah, I had the sense that it was in the tens of thousands, but we can get that information for you.
Thank you.
Okay, Representative Whalen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And forgive me if this was already addressed, but I'm just thinking that I know that the university, I'm looking back at their PowerPoint when they presented a few weeks ago their request, and they've asked for more funds for their medical school. Mm-hmm. If we didn't increase this allocation and left it at the base, which I believe was 14.82 or something to that effect, could they just decide to make up that difference with the funds that we are giving them and do it? You know, so we don't have to allocate more money to the med school.
Well, let me respond to that question. Thank you. I think the initiative you're referring to, the proposal to fund the medical school with $5 and $25 million over the next biennium, that's been presented by the dean and the president of the university, is explicitly to use for recruiting new faculty to the university under the umbrella of these so-called medical discovery teams. The funding for the partnership is used to support grant applications submitted by all faculty at the university, or Mayo, I should say. And as it turns out, the partnership grant program is now so successful and visible that we use this as part of a recruiting tool when we're trying to recruit faculty to either Mayo or the university. So they have very distinct, but I would argue, complementary functions.
Representative.
Thank you. So I guess for what I'm just thinking, with the limited resources that we have as a state to allocate funds, I would, if they are working together and in tandem, I would want to maybe see if we could reduce the allocation then for this request and to fund this, or just find a balance there, because it just seems like we're going to be allocating a lot of money if we go forward with this and that proposal. So just something to think about, I guess.
Any other questions from members? Oh, Representative Norton, I'm sorry.
I'd like to address that. It's something I've asked regularly at committee hearings, and these are very different programs. The program for the Genomics Partnership requires a partner from each working together on in a specific team goes through and approves these grants as they've described. The university has it's an entirely separate budget for their medical school and, in fact, for the regenerative medicine research and for other avenues. The dental school and the veterinary school and ag school all have their own, you know, different budgets. I will say one of the, and this was interesting to me, the year, and Mr. Chair, you might have been in that same position when this happened, when we were trimming the university's budget and making the 14% cuts, I think you had to, you know, have your name with. That next year, the University of Minnesota actually had to make those cuts, and one of the cuts they made when they made their cuts was a cut to this line item. And to me, I was quite upset, many of us were, because this is a separate, very purposeful expenditure in this line item that we did, and yet the university made cuts across the board. So if you look at the language, it says in there that if the university is going to make cuts to this program, they need to come to the chairs who actually approved that funding for this program very specifically before any further cuts are made. We can't really stop them from doing it, but we can make certain that they report it. That's the direction they're heading, so we know. So I would just say they are different funding sources. They have different purposes. There is a big request for research, but we happen to be blessed in this state with nation-leading research, and hopefully we'll continue that as best we can with the funding available.
Any other questions? Anyone in the audience want to testify for or against? I see none. So any final word? You just gave us the final word.
I think I gave you enough final word.
Then Representative Norton renews the motion that House File 1108 be laid over for possible inclusion in our final bill. Thank you.
Thank you. Yeah,
Mr. Chair, thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Next, we have Representative Fenton. House File 1347. Welcome to the committee, and we need someone to make that motion. Huh? Oh.
I would make that motion.
Okay. Representative Heitzman makes the motion that House File 1347 be laid over for possible inclusion in our final bill. And welcome to the committee, Representative Fenton.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, members. House File 1347, the Alternative Teacher Preparation Grant Program. Well, first of all, I will start by saying that a teacher shortage is an education crisis. And what better way to offset a teacher shortage than by an Alternative Teacher Preparation Grant Program. This program will do a few things. It will have a highly selective process for program participants, and it will have the history of selecting participants that increase the diversity of Minnesota's teaching workforce. What would the grant money be used for? Expenses related to recruitment, selection, and training of teachers, ongoing professional development of teachers, regional management and operational support development, and central services, including finance, technology, and human services. So with that, I would like to turn it over to the testifiers that have joined me today to talk more about this.
Welcome to the committee. If you'd like to identify yourself and then proceed.
Anil Hercodley, Teach for America. Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, good afternoon, and thank you for having me. On behalf of Teach for America, I'm asking you to support 1347 because there is a need for an objective and a competitive process to fund and expand programs that offer alternative pathways to teaching in Minnesota. This past year, TFA sought to strengthen its effectiveness in teacher preparation and ongoing support by partnering with the University of Minnesota to create an alternative teacher preparation program. Our partnership with the University of Minnesota a nationally recognized preparation program, has helped strengthen and refine our two-year professional development trajectory, and it has helped us situate it squarely within the state of Minnesota and the communities that we are privileged to work with each and every single day. Through the passage of HF 1347, TFA will have the opportunity to compete for funding that will support our programmatic work to recruit, select, and develop new teachers for the state of Minnesota. As a state, we must do everything within our power to identify and train great, diverse teachers who will ensure every student is on a path toward college, career, and life success. That means supporting our traditional teacher preparation programs, as well as looking to alternative pathways to teaching. TFA contributes to this important work by recruiting top college graduates and seasoned professionals to commit to teach for at least 2 years in high-need schools and to then become lifelong leaders for educational equity. Today in Minnesota, we have 68 classroom teachers in their first 2 years as core members and 149 classroom teachers in their third year or more of teaching. This amounts to an impact on nearly 12,000 students daily. The diversity of our state's teaching force matters because it's important for the success of our students' increasingly diverse student population. Of the group of new teachers who entered Twin Cities classrooms this fall through Teach for America, over half identified as people of color and or coming from a low-income background. That important trend is going to continue with our new teachers entering the classroom this fall. This year, 300 seniors from 20 colleges and universities across Minnesota applied to TFA. And nationally, over 1,500 people who applied to Teach for America indicated that the Twin Cities was a region in their top tier of preference for where they wanted to teach. TFA teachers are hired to fill vacancies in traditionally hard-to-fill roles, such as bilingual, ESL, math, and science placements. Teachers in their first 2 years are currently working in 27 schools across the Twin Cities, including Minneapolis Public Schools, Hiawatha Leadership Academies, Harvest Prep and Best Academy, and Brooklyn Center Schools. I want to close my remarks by sharing an example from our current first year, one of our current first-year teachers, and I believe that she exemplifies why it's really important to support alternative pathways alongside our traditional preparation programs. This core member grew up in North Minneapolis and was considered a visionary by her peers as a child for simply starting a sentence, "When I go to college." A graduate of Gustavus, she believes that growing up in North Minneapolis and experiencing exactly how educational inequity plays out here helps her be a more culturally competent and effective teacher who can empower her students to see themselves as the leaders our community needs. And we agree. Let me be clear. We support strengthening all teacher preparation programs and improving our investments in alternative preparation programs through competitive grant making. We ask that you support HF 1347. Thank you for your time and consideration.
Thank you. Identify yourself. Are you Ms. Dillon?
I am. Okay. Thank you.
Please identify yourself and then proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chairperson. I'm Deborah Dillon. I serve as the Associate Dean for Graduate and Professional Programs at the University of Minnesota in the College of Education and Human Development. And I thank you for allowing me to be here today and to share our perspective and also sit in partnership with my colleague from Teach for America. In my role as Associate Dean, I oversee all of our educator preparation and administrator preparation programs. These include the innovative post-baccalaureate program, which is a conventional, if you will, form of teacher preparation. I oversee the Board of Teaching conditionally approved alternative pathway to teaching program, the partnership with TFA, the first in the state of Minnesota. And I oversee a newly proposed non-conventional Minneapolis residency program, a University of Minnesota Minneapolis Public Schools partnership that I want to tell you a little bit about. In all of our pathways to teaching, our goal over numerous years at the university, along with support from the Bush Foundation, which is funding research on how to best prepare teachers, has been to create high-quality programs and to diversify the teaching force. In fact, our number of students has risen over the last few years from 9% across all of the pathways to 13.7%. and our international student teaching population has increased, and our males that we're preparing to go into the teaching force has also increased by 27.4%. We expect that these trends will continue to go upwards for a number of reasons. We believe that expanding access to high-quality preparation programs to the teaching force at the University of Minnesota and making pathways to teaching more affordable are the keys to recruiting and retaining outstanding, smart, committed individuals, especially persons of color, who desire to be teachers. And truly, these individuals need scholarship money to be able to go on to school if we want to attract the very most outstanding individuals to the teaching field. Seeking additional scholarship money has been a key goal of our College of Education and Human Development, and the way we've gone about it thus far is that we've really worked with donors who are deeply committed and passionate about putting excellent teachers in the classroom. So, for example, we've typically award between 16 and 23 scholarships a year at about $7,700 per candidate to candidates of color. But this is not nearly enough to attract and retain all exceptional candidates of color who seek to be teachers. And that's why this legislation is really key. But I think it's important to talk about the three pathways to teaching and what makes them differ and why all three are worthy of consideration in terms of this funding. The first is what people would refer to as conventional preparation, or sometimes traditional. And at the University of Minnesota, we no longer consider it traditional preparation because we do have a 15 to 18 month preparation program. We take the most talented individuals who have bachelor's degrees where they have a deep knowledge in a disciplinary like science or mathematics or a foreign language, and they come into our post-baccalaureate program. Most of them have between a 3.40 and higher out of 4.0 GPA who enter our program, and they then are 94% of them candidates from the state of Minnesota who have every intention of staying in Minnesota and contributing to our youth in this state. The program component includes an intensive summer program, and then in the comprehensive program, the students teach for an entire school year daily, side by side with an experienced mentor teacher. And when they complete that program, we recommend them for licensure to the state of Minnesota. The candidates step out practically with a year's worth of teaching under their belts, and over 95% of them are hired immediately, if not in the school setting where they did their year-long residency, somewhere here in the area or across the state. That's the conventional preparation program. The second form of preparation is what we would refer to as the alternative pathway. And what makes the alternative pathway different, and this is our partnership with Teach for America and the Northside Achievement Zone, is that we begin again with an 8-week intensive summer residency program, but that's followed by 2 years of additional coursework where the candidates are actually the teacher of record. They're in the classroom by themselves as the teacher with excellent coaching that takes place from the University of Minnesota, from our TFA colleagues, and from the public school personnel. And that kind of support for those individuals is really important as they continue their coursework. And over the course of 2 years, successfully, we want to recommend them as teachers of record. And they have a conditional or a provisional license while they're in that particular capacity. Then I want to just note the third pathway. And this is a brand new pathway called non-conventional. This is where our partnership with the Minneapolis Public Schools comes in. The Minneapolis Public Schools would like to engage in what's called a Grow Your Own. They have outstanding educational teaching aides, many of whom have advanced degrees, who are looking to be prepared as teachers. They don't have a teaching license.
Can we interrupt for just a moment? We have a question, a clarification from one of the members, Representative Isaacson.
Yes, sir.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you. I just have a question. I'm not sure that I understood what you said. You said that the conventional pathway, can you just maybe run through again real quick what the conventional pathway and then break down what the alternative pathway is? I think I might have got them confused. I just want to make sure I understand them. Thank you.
Yes, sir. I'd be happy to do that. So the conventional pathway would be someone who potentially would come out of 4 years of college, would have a bachelor's degree, and seeks to become a teacher and gain their license. So they would go through a post-baccalaureate program at the university, which is a 15 to 18 month program. And part of that program is that they would spend a year co-teaching in a classroom side by side with an experienced person as they learn how to teach. And when they exit that program, we would recommend them for licensure. The alternative pathway program, they have, again, an intensive program in the summer. These folks also have a bachelor's degree. But they would begin immediately in the fall after that 8-week intensive program as the sole teacher of record with a provisional license. And for 2 years, they would teach with the provisional license while they continue to go through coursework and program support until they're then recommended for a full license. This is the alternative pathway to teaching program. This is our partnership with TFA. And then the third pathway, which is called non-conventional, is a pathway where we have excellent individuals such as the educational teaching aides in the Minneapolis Public Schools who desire greatly to become a classroom teacher, but for whom leaving their job and the classroom is cost prohibitive. And so what we've done is we've partnered with the Minneapolis Public Schools, and we're going to be offering a program where they have an intensive summer. Then they teach side by side with an experienced classroom teacher in Minneapolis. They continue with an additional second summer of coursework, and at the end of that, they would be recommended for full licensure. So it's very similar to the conventional program, except that they're homegrown teachers in Minneapolis who represent the diversity and the community from which they come. So I tell you about those three pathways because I think it's really important when we're looking at this legislative opportunity to think about the wording. And I've certainly commented on this with my colleague Anil, about the proposed legislation, which I'm very appreciative of, but I would like to respectfully ask the committee to consider extending the term alternative pathway to teacher preparation grant program to alternative and non-conventional. And what this would allow is that there would be other pathways to teaching that equally would diversify the teaching field and would be of high quality, would attract excellent people to the field, but which would receive funding for the very people that need that. And with that, I respectfully would end my comments.
Okay. Thank you. Any other questions of the two testifiers? There are other testifiers, I believe. Representative Norton?
I just need, again, clarification based on that what I just heard. So the bill before us is just asking for funding to do what we're currently doing, which is the alternative teacher funding. What you were talking about is a request to add a third way for the non-conventional, but that is not part of this bill. Am I understanding that correctly?
Mr. Chair, Representative, yes, I'm asking that not just the alternative pathway be the only program that we would consider for this grant funding, but that we would extend that to also include non-conventional programs. So a program like the Grow Your Own with the Minneapolis Public Schools, where they have outstanding individuals, persons of color who wish to be teachers, would also be competitive for that grant funding.
Representative Norton.
And thank you. But to me, that suggestion changes my support for this bill. If what I'm seeing here is that there is no amendment to do what you're suggesting, but you're just moving this bill, is that what I'm saying? And you're just talking about something else you'd like to see, but it is not a part of the bill in front of us. Can you clarify this for me?
Representative Fenton.
So thank you, Mr. Chair. Basically, with this is, first of all, I wanted to say we are committed to working on the language as we move forward in the process. But part of this alternative teacher prep grant program is to allow the commissioner of Minnesota Office of Higher Ed to kind of help shape, give him, to open the program up to other opportunities for the licensure and help shape that. But again, we're committed to working on the language as we move forward with the process.
Representative Norton, are you done?
Well, Mr. Chair, I'm looking at the language, and I'm not seeing us giving that kind of leeway in the language that's here now, which gives me comfort and would allow me to support the bill. But if we're going to go too far out there and give them authority to do something that, in my mind, is inappropriate, that someone who doesn't even have a bachelor's degree would get full licensure with 2 summers of training, that makes me nervous, and I'm less comfortable with that. So I don't see that here. So if I've misunderstood, I'm just trying to get this clear, because I'm, what I'm hearing and what I'm seeing on paper are different.
Ms. Dillon.
Mr. Chair, Representative, if I could address that. So all of the candidates that I mentioned, from the conventional to the alternative pathway to the non-conventional, all of those individuals would have a bachelor's degree.
That feels better. Thank you for that clarification. That helps.
Okay, thank you. Representative Isaacs.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So, first of all, appreciate the clarification before, but it does set up another set of questions for me about this. And part of it is just doing a little bit of homework on one part. The current program allows for the first two options, and then as Representative Norton said, you guys were considering or thinking about a third option as we go down the road. In the first two options, when the alternative pathway where someone, was it 8-week course? Is that what you said? And then they would get 2 years of being the sole teacher of record. What qualifications does that person have to get to that point with you guys? What is it they're bringing to the table that leads us to the point where we're saying that this is their best next step? Can you maybe just walk me through that just briefly?
Ms. Dillon? Chairperson, Representative, so if I might, sir, please just correct one thing, and that is that this bill, as proposed right now, focuses on just providing grant funding for the alternative pathway, which is the one that's the intensive 8-week program, followed by two additional years where the teacher has a provisional license for 2 years and is a sole teacher of record in the classroom. That that is based on legislation that's already been passed.
Correct. I've just got a question about it, that's all.
Yes, sir. And so the comprehensive program that I mentioned, where there's the co-teaching model that would be both for the University of Minnesota students we currently prepare in a post-baccalaureate program, and then the non-conventional, which is what I described for the Minneapolis Public School Partnership, those would not be considered for this grant funding at this moment.
Right. So,
Representative Isaacs.
Thank you, sir. I'm aware. I'm with you on that. We're on the same page. What I wanted to know, going back, is when you're selecting people to be a part of the alternative teaching program, what qualifications are they bringing to the table that makes you think that they're ready to do the teaching, be ready for be a part of the program? Like, what are they? Like, I know what I need if I want to go back and become a high school teacher. I'm a college teacher now. I have to do X, Y, and Z through a graduate program. What are they bringing that tells you that they're ready to go into this particular as the next best avenue for them to become a teacher?
And I can answer to that question. So what qualifies as part of our selection process for candidates for the core is achievement in terms of undergraduate outcomes, so GPA, a demonstrated track record of leadership, and that can mean any number of things in order to be an inclusive process to ensure diversity for the core. And so that goes for our undergraduate candidates, it goes for the seasoned professionals that we're also recruiting. And I will add that you know, the clarification on whether or not this is an 8, although this summer, a 9-week summer training residency, it starts with that 9 weeks, but then continues through the graduate coursework that happens over the course of the 2 years. And our teachers also participate in the same evaluation process as any other teacher of record in their school, and you know, also includes the licensure exams that any other teacher also has to pass before becoming a teacher of record.
Could I get you to identify yourself? I didn't get your name before.
Sure. It's Anil Herkadli.
Okay. Mm-hmm. Thank you. Representative Isaacson.
Thank you. And so you guys have identified someone that you think would be good. They have a desire to become a teacher. They're looking at the alternative pathways. They fill what your criteria that you listed are. They go into the 8 or 9 week intensive course, and they're the teacher of record for 2 years while concurrently doing other graduate course. Are they finishing with a degree in 2 years then?
Ms. Dillon?
Sir, they will finish with the coursework and the requirements and the requisite accreditation processes that they need to have to be recommended to the state for licensure. They will not finish a master's degree, although they'll be very close to that. They'll be within 6 hours of a master's degree.
And I understand that's kind of a standard procedure for lots of folks so they can get hired. I get that part of it.
Representative Isaacson?
Thank you, sir. Sorry. What you're asking for is more money to go into that particular specific program. And what is the number you've done so far? I think you covered that, but.
So the first year, the first summer was last summer, and we had 38 people enter the program.
And
Representative Isaacson?
Thank you. Where are they primarily being placed at?
Are you asking about content area or geographic?
I'm sorry, that's a good question. Geographically. Well, let's answer both now that you've said it. That's a good idea.
So geographically, it's across the Twin Cities. So there are 27 schools. This includes within MPS and charter schools.
Mm-hmm.
The other public districts, Brooklyn Center and Brooklyn Park, we have small placements there as well. And then in terms of content, I believe I have that information with me right now, about two-thirds are in elementary or bilingual.
Mm-hmm.
We have general science placements at about 20%. Actually, no, this is for next fall. Physics, we have one placement. ESL, we have two placements. And then we have one placement in math. And so for right now where we are, because we are still expecting more candidates to come in as part of our national recruitment process,
mm-hmm.
We have 24 teachers entering the program for next year. But I can get you the information from last year's first-year program participants. I just don't have that in front of me right now.
One more time. That's
okay. Just going to say we have three more witnesses and two more bills, so we need to move along here as much as we
yes,
can.
Sir.
Representative Isaacson.
And you said this was legislation passed in 2013?
No, I believe it was 2011. Yeah, the original bill was 2011.
All right, that makes more sense. Thank you.
Representative Winkler?
Yep.
You have
pass.
A question? Go pass. Okay. Representative Rosenthal.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and whoever wants to answer this question. On line 1.12 of the bill, it says highly selective, meaning accepting less than 25% of applicants. Could you tell me what that means and how you came up with that?
Ms. Dillon?
Yes, Mr. Chairperson, Representative. I believe that that language is referring to looking at the number of excellent candidates from across the country that apply to Teach for America and the number that are eventually selected to be part of the program, and then the number that are actually selected to be part of the Minneapolis cohort. So it's a highly selective number of outstanding candidates based on their academic preparation and their commitment to working with students who are most in need of having excellent teachers.
Mr. Chair,
Rosenthal.
And the 25%, is that based in study or is that an arbitrary percentage?
Mr. Chairperson? I must confess that I was not part of writing that, and that is one area that I might offer amended language to, because if you have a cohort of outstanding people and they all have highly qualified credentials and they're a high proportion of teachers of color that we definitely want into the teaching force, such as the Minneapolis residency program, 25% could be a number that would not allow all of those excellent people in. So I would respectfully amend that language.
I do think it's worth thinking through, and I think the definition of highly selective comes from when we look at graduate programs across the country, when we would deem them selective, highly selective, looking at a number that's variable to accommodate for, you know, what we're seeing as a national trend in teacher preparation program acceptances and applications. And so I think right now what we base it on is what we know and what we define as highly selective, but that's something that we would respectfully work with the committee on working on definition.
Representative Rosenthal.
Mr. Chair, thank you, and to the testifiers. It seems to me that we, in the conference committee on the higher education bill in 2013, which the chair was part of, this issue came up, and the governor vetoed it, and this seems to be a response to that in some way. But it seems to me that it's really targeted towards Teach for America again. And so who are these other groups of people that you intend to target?
Representative Penn.
So you are accurate that it does address some of the concerns that Governor Dayton had in a letter to the President of the Senate. He'd stated that his principal concern was that, to his knowledge, there was no competitive grant program established. So that is the purpose of this piece of legislation, is to establish that grant program, put it in the hands of the commissioner for Minnesota's higher ed, and have and allow him to put a process in place so that we can certify, so that we can move forward with an alternative certification process in an effort to get teachers in the classroom, as we want to offset a shortage. But this is an answer to that. It was a concern, but again, this is placed in the hands of the commissioner for the Minnesota Office of Higher Ed to develop this process.
Representative Rosenthal.
Mr. Chair, can you tell me where these teachers, sort of along the lines of Representative Isaacson, did they go into classrooms that are crowded, say 30 students or more, with the finite training that they've had?
Ms. Dillon.
Mr. Chairperson, Representative. Some of our placements are in the most needy and diverse schools in Minneapolis and in the surrounding areas. We try our best to place students in situations where they're going to be successful, and then we offer them additional supports so that as a first-year teacher that they have the mentoring that they need. And I apologize that I cannot tell you the exact class size of each of the students and what they're working with, but it could range up to 28 to 32 students per classroom.
Representative Rosenthal.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I'll be short. That just seems to be a pretty high burden to put on a very, very new teacher with relatively little experience trying to help the students that need it most, instead of having a teacher that's been trained on a yearly basis following a teacher of record around. And it seems to me they'd be more prepared in that situation than the new teacher.
And I think it's worth pointing out once again that our teachers are held to the same state standards as other folks from conventional programs. And they are, again, participating in the same evaluation process as any other teacher. And so we are very mindful of ensuring that teachers are prepared to be in front of a classroom of students. So I appreciate that.
We need to move on to the other witnesses if possible. Representative Rosenthal.
Thank you. Thank you, Chair Nornes. Can you tell me how many of the teachers that enroll in this program are still teaching in our public schools after 3 or 4 years?
So I don't have the specific numbers in front of me right now, but I will say that the folks who ended the two-year program last June, 90% of them decided to stay for a third year. I will say that, you know, part of the use of these funds is on the selection of local candidates and local retention. And I think that's an issue that, you know, any program, conventional, traditional, alternative, is struggling with right now, given that nationally 50% of teachers don't stay in the classroom, and I think that's around the same here locally. So that is still very, very much in our mind, but I will say that the numbers locally are very promising with our teachers.
Representative Winkler.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Fenton, on page 2, lines 2.6 and 2.7, it outlines what the uses of the grant can be, and it includes management, operational support, development, central services, including finance, technology, and human services. It's all pretty much administrative expenses to the organization, and there's no limit on how much of the grant can be used for those purposes. And, you know, in general, if you probably in your first session of the legislature, you can probably figure out that some bills are designed to really just hand money to specific groups, and you just can't write it that way. So you write criteria that only you know that only certain groups are likely to be able to qualify for. And so what I'm concerned about is that we have effectively a direct appropriation to a private nonprofit organization or organizations, and we're funding their central services, their administrative costs, without limitation. And I don't think that's what we're in the business of doing.
And I want to clarify, Representative Winkler.
Representative Fenton.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. This is not a direct appropriation to Teach for America. To me, this is, I'm asking for the competitive grant process, and any program that meets the criteria can apply. And that's why I put this in the hands of the commissioner of the Minnesota Office of Higher Ed to develop and open that enrollment for any program to be able to apply. specifically chief authored this because I have experience in alternative certification in both writing our own program for the school district I worked for back in Texas, as well as working with Teach for America interns. And so my intent is just to start the competitive grant program, offer it for anybody that meets the criteria to apply, and let's get good high-quality teachers in our classroom and offset a shortage. There is a shortage somewhere in the inner cities you're hearing, but in greater Minnesota as well. So.
Representative Winkler. Mr. Chair, Representative Fenton, do you know how many organizations meet the criteria set forth in your bill that are highly selective, meaning they accept less than 25%, that they are approved under Minnesota statutes 122A.245, which is done through the Board of Teaching, and has this particular set of history regarding increasing diversity? I mean, how many organizations actually exist that could qualify?
Representative Fenton?
I don't have a number for that. I believe that Minneapolis has an alternative certification program as well. But again, like I said, I want to work with any committee members in here to make this bill better. I'm open to working with people as this moves forward through the process.
Speaking of moving, we do need to move ahead with, you have three more witnesses. Can they be real brief? Ms. Dillon, do you have a comment?
Yes, Mr. Chairperson, if I might clarify that point. Right now at this time in the state of Minnesota, there's only one program that's been conditionally approved as an alternative pathway program, and that is the University of Minnesota TFA Partnership Program. And that is part of the reason that I was interested in respectfully asking that the language be expanded to include non-conventional preparation programs, because we would have other approved programs by the Board of Teaching which would allow more than one competitive grant.
Okay, thank you.
Representative Fenton, this bill will be moving on to the Education Policy Committee. That's different than the original motion that we made earlier.
I'm fine with that.
Okay. So I say that only because there will be another opportunity for more testimony. So you can decide right now. The other testifiers can certainly come down, but they have to be very, very brief because we have two more bills that we have to get through today.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Cindy Christ. I represent MACTE, the Minnesota Association of Colleges for Teacher Education. Every point I have in my list has been made either by questions or comments raised by members of the committee or other testifiers. So I will just briefly hit on all of them. MACTE has four key issues with this bill. The first is the definition of diverse candidates. Not only do I think it's, personally, it's kind of strange to define types of people, I think for purposes of a bill like this, we probably would be interested in diversity on the base of race, ethnicity, perhaps socioeconomic status, and first language or English language learner skills. I'm not sure that we have an issue with gender, generally speaking, in teacher preparation. Our second issue is another that's been raised, and that is the issue of highly selective. Simply saying that you're going to accept less than 25% of applicants tells you nothing about the quality of the pool. I mean, you could have, for sake of argument, you could have every candidate with a GPA of 2.5, which is the minimum required by Teach for America and several of our other post-bac programs in the state. And 25% of that pool of candidates all with 2.5, I don't think we would consider highly selective. So I think that's a definition that really needs to address accurately the issue at hand. Third is the purpose. We think it's a little strange that there's no stated purpose in this bill, though it is implied. But it would seem that the purpose of this would be something like attracting high-quality, diverse candidates into Minnesota classrooms and providing them with the skills they need to improve student learning or student achievement. And that leads then to the fourth point, and that is the criteria for selection. as several of you have pointed out, there really isn't any other program in Minnesota that fits the criteria here other than Teach for America. So I think it's a little inadvertently, on the author's part, clearly disingenuous to create something as a competitive grant program when there's only one potential competitor. So there are a number of ways in which that could be changed. One is to focus more on the criteria that you're seeking to achieve and allow any program that can demonstrate those commitments to diversity and quality to apply. Another would be to keep the categories more defined, but as Dr. Dillon suggested, add non-conventional programs. Or there are other ways to define alternative pathways besides that in the statutory reference. In addition to the Minneapolis program that Dr. Dillon mentioned, I would also mention as another potential applicant, should the criteria be revised a bit, the TC2 residency program, which is the Bush-funded program that involves, I think, six private schools in the metropolitan area. So we would love to see this as a truly competitive grant program, and that's something that MACD could support. But if it's going to be competitive, there needs to be more than one potential competitor.
Former Representative Klensing, welcome. Welcome back.
Thank you. My name is Karen Klensing, and I'm actually here really on my own today, not representing a specific organization, but representing a perspective from having been in the administrative world of trying to hire teachers over the last 3 years for a high school. And one of the things that hasn't been discussed a lot is the kind of candidate we end up having to use for classrooms when we can't find a licensed candidate, and we end up putting the candidate who's now teaching on a community waiver, and we get that community waiver, or we get the 1 year license provisional for that candidate to teach for 1 year, and then maybe a second on a variance. Up to 3 years if the candidate's willing to do that, because it's very difficult these days to find a chemistry teacher, a physics teacher, actually an English teacher sometimes with a master's degree to teach some of the college and the schools or other programs are trying to offer. There's such a huge push these days, and it's an excellent push for students, even students who are in some of these high-flying charter schools in the inner cities that are serving low-income students who are finally, you know, getting a really awesome access to college prep. In high school, these students need to access college preparatory classes that sometimes will require these teachers to have a full master's degree in the subject area in which they're teaching. And what I want to tell you is, with that problem that we've actually had for 10 years since I was sitting in those seats out there, with that problem there is a solution, and I've seen it in action. And I hired teachers who actually did the TFA program, but they did it in another state, and they came back here to Minnesota because they love Minnesota, and they did it because they were inspired to teach. But they couldn't do TFA here, so they went elsewhere and did it to find out if they really liked it. They had a content major, and they did this. They're Minnesotans, and they're coming back, and they were trained in TFA. And they're excellent. There is no pedagogical problems that I ran into with these teachers, and in fact, I have to point out that a couple of our professional learning communities, we always hand-picked some of those teachers because they were the most inspirational leaders for these professional learning communities. But this, I like the fact that this is structured as a competitive grant. I do want to point out one thing where it says it only meets criteria for one program, or only one program meets this. Part of that problem is the difficulty in these programs getting approved by the Board of Teaching. So we've got kind of a chicken or egg problem with why is it that there's only one program that meets these criteria, and it was difficult even for that program to get approved. So I want to also point out, though, the reason why I think it's important that this is a competitive grant program is that I had a computer science teacher who we wanted to get her license in math because kids loved her. She did not go through the TFA program, but we were seeking some sort of alternative access point for her because she was had three kids at home, and the typical structured program wasn't really going to meet her needs, and she'd already shown us in the classroom how good she was at teaching. So this, I think, is a great way to put some money into the incentives in the right place, get it measured, get it researched, and help to troubleshoot some of these problems that I just spoke of that don't just exist in one school, but they exist across the state, primarily in the rural areas.
Thank you very much. Mr. Bartholomew, can you really abbreviate?
Yes, Mr. Chair. Members, my name is Jim Bartholomew with the Minnesota Business Partnership, and thank you for the opportunity to speak in support of House File 1347. And I guess rather than saying what I was planning to, I would just remind folks, as you know, we're going through demographic changes, both in terms of our student population becoming more diverse and our teaching workforce is becoming more experienced or closer to retirement. Now, those are both a challenge and an opportunity. And we've supported this because it's a supplement to our existing teacher prep programs. And to Representative Winkler and others, if on the bottom of page 1, lines 1.13 through 1.22, if there's a desire to look at that clause 1 about the highly selective, to open that up a little bit, I think that's fine. But those next two are really pretty key in the sense that it's a program that has a history of selecting participants to improve diversity, and it has a track record of success in positively impacting student achievement. Those are two really critical factors that, as a supplemental grant program, if this can make a difference, why wouldn't we do that? And then just finally, again, in response to some of the concerns, the provision on subdivision 4 about the evaluation, the ability for the Office of Higher Ed to ask for basically a compliance report from whoever is receiving a grant is a great accountability measure also.
Thank you very much. We've had a lengthy discussion, and Representative Fenton, I think we're going to move along, and unless you got two or three final words, but...
No, I've taken the notes of those who testified, and I'll look forward to working as this bill moves along.
Okay, very good.
Thank you.
Representative Heitzman amends his earlier motion. The House File 1347 now be referred to the Education Policy Committee. All those in favor? Say aye.
Aye.
Opposed?
No.
It carries. We have two other bills, and I'm told they're both going to be brief, and they both want to leave first. So I think right now, Representative Knobloch, you're up. The chair moves House File 228. To be referred to the Tax Committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and I'd appreciate if you'd also move the A150088 amendment, which is really just a technical amendment to get the bill into the right form.
Okay, we'll move the A150088 amendment. All those in favor? Say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Amendment has been adopted. So, Representative Knobloch.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, House File 228 is a simple bill which brings to I did not know, and that is that scholarships and scholarships and fellowships are currently non-taxable for federal income tax purposes. They are non-taxable for state income tax purposes. However, in figuring out your property tax refund, they are treated as taxable income. And so I have a student that contacted me that talked about how he was surprised to be dunned by the Department of Revenue for $800 to get back the property tax refund that they had sent him. And I think this is in your packet. There is a letter from an Andrew Shedlock. He couldn't be here because of a work situation. But basically all this does is it just says that when you're figuring out your property tax refund, your renter's credit, you don't have to include in your income your scholarship or a non-taxable fellowship that you would have. And I guess to me, I think that students that are going to college that are getting a scholarship or getting a fellowship, that shouldn't be treated as income for purposes of determining their property tax refund. It's not treated as income for their state tax. It's not treated as income for their federal tax. Most of them have loans anyway and are just already struggling to get by. And so I'd encourage your support for House File 228.
Thank you for that brief explanation. Any questions? It sounds like good bill. Representative Winkler.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Knobloch, how did they find this? How did the Department of Revenue must have been doing some amazing work to figure this out, because I'm pretty certain when I was in law school, I got by with it and didn't know it.
Well, Knobloch. Mr. Chair, do you know what the statute of limitations for this is?
3 years, Representative Knobloch.
I assure you, Representative Winkler, the Department of Revenue is very diligent and becoming ever more so.
Any other questions? If not, I will renew my motion that House File 228, as amended, be referred to the Tax Committee. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? It's on its way.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members.
Representative Detmer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and committee members.
I will move that, the chair will move that House File 841 be referred to the General Register. And Representative Detmer, you may go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'll try to be quicker.
We have time now. I misjudged. Sorry.
I was willing to flip a coin with your...
So we gave you an extra 25 minutes.
Let's take a look at I have an amendment, A3 amendment. I'd like to move that, Mr. Chair.
Okay, would you like to explain the amendment?
Well, when I put the bill together, I noticed that we have other armed forces besides the National Guard. So I wanted to make sure that any active member of the reserve component of the United States Armed Forces, whether you're Army, Navy, Air Force, Marines, that they also be included in this. So
okay.
Just a technical change.
Any other questions on the amendment? Hearing none, all those in favor, say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? The amendment is adopted.
And Mr. Chair, 841, the Office of Higher Education administers a number of grants and scholarships programs to help students with their education. And I got a call a couple weeks ago from a soldier in the National Guard, indicated that he lives in Minnesota and is enrolled in college, but he has to wait for 12 months before he or she, in this case, he had a couple other people too that had the same situation. They had to wait 12 months before they qualify for some of these different grants. And I was pretty impressed because he had the statute. He was reading the statute to me, and there was 9 different elements within the statute that these soldiers, in this case, didn't meet. So what my bill does, I added, if you look at the language in the bill, I added number 10, which is the amendment. And so if you are living in Minnesota and you are enrolled in college and you're also a member of the armed forces here in Minnesota and your duty station is here in Minnesota, that you would qualify for those loans and grants and not have to wait for 12 months. So that's the bill.
All right. Very good. And you are here to testify on behalf of the bill, I assume. Would you identify yourself for
the
record?
Yes, Chair. My name is Don Kerr. I'm the Executive Director of the Department of Military Affairs, and Representative Detmer asked us to look at the bill and asked if we would support it, and the Department of Military Affairs does support it because we believe it would benefit some of our men.
Okay. Questions? Yeah, Representative O'Neill.
Thank you, Chair. Thank you, Representative Detmer, for bringing this forward. I have a son that's in the Army Reserve right now, and he was actually told he couldn't use his GI benefits for a year, even though in recruitment they said he could. But in reality, he's working as a Pizza Hut driver with a pregnant wife and no benefits. So does this? Are there other situations in which an Army Reserve recruit would be excluded from enacting their GI Bill in addition to what you have in this bill? And maybe it's more for the military.
Mr. Chair, basically what this bill does, my understanding that if you come into the state, you can use your GI Bill benefits within the state here. This covers any types of other grants and other loans that are available for people that are here in the state and also living. Maybe Mr. Kerr can address that too.
Go ahead.
Mr. Chair, Representative, the depending on what type of benefit and whether it's a federal benefit or a state benefit, this bill will only affect grants that are administered by the Department of Higher Education. More than likely, your son is talking about federal tuition assistance, and I'd be happy to talk with the offline afterwards to get the nitty-gritty of that. But the federal government has changed the rules on utilization of that in the last few months, and that's probably what's caught him.
Thank you, Representative O'Neill. So this would be outside of what the federal government just changed with the regulations recently then. Okay, so this is catching the catch-22 of move into the state, being a military member, and not being able to access our grants. And
Mr. Chair and Representative, yes, that's correct.
Okay.
Any other questions? Otherwise, Waylon?
Sorry, Mr. Chair, real briefly. I was just thinking... For other states, is there, if our, you know, Minnesotan is an active member of the Guard in Texas, do they do the same thing?
Mr. Chair?
Detmer?
No, you have to live in Minnesota, and you have to be enrolled in college here in Minnesota.
Right. Sorry, maybe I didn't phrase the question correctly. Do you know of other states that do a similar thing for out-of-state members that are serving? So if I... as a Minnesotan, move to Texas, I want to go to college in Texas, and I'm serving in their guard, would they do what we're trying to do?
Mr. Chair, Representative, I had a couple people from Wisconsin that drilled in Minnesota, but this would not apply to them. You would have to be a resident of Minnesota to get these benefits. And I don't know of any other states that to answer your question, I don't know of any other states that have this.
All right. The chair then renews the motion that House File 841 as amended be referred to the General Register. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? And there
thank
it is.
You. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Before we adjourn, members, years ago when I was a member of the Kiwanis, well, I still am a member, but I was, one of my duties was to give you information as a club member. So as committee members, I've got some information here you need to have. The Vikings have signed a new quarterback Sean Hill, so make that a note. The Dow has plunged 330 points today. It's a very active day. And looks like the Wild won again, 5-3. So with that, we're adjourned.